Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Josh Twist. Josh is a program manager in the Windows Azure team and was the first full-time member of the Mobile Services Project, which I very much want to talk to him about. He's worked at Microsoft for 6 years, the first four as a consultant in the UK, and now he's in Redmond at the Mothership. Josh, how are you?
I'm great, Jesse. How are you?
I am great. Doing really very well and very happy to have you here.
Well, do you know, likewise, before I got into this mobile space, I did a lot of Silverlight work and a lot of WPF work. So I've been following the Liberty for a while now. So it's really great to, it's great to meet you.
Well, it's very good to meet you. And I have to say that I had two exposures to Windows Mobile Services. The first real exposure was at Build, mm-hmm. where they were holding a contest and you had to follow through the tutorial, which was absurdly easy. And then That's the second, great. In order to win this toy car, you had to build a variant on that application.
Uh-huh.
And we had about literally 3 minutes to get it done because we were, you know, I was at a booth and finishing up. And so we had to bang this thing out in 3 minutes, and it was hysterically funny. But we got it done.
So you built an app on mobile services in 3 minutes,
yes,
right?
Yes.
There you go. I think you've nailed what we're about, though. I don't even have to pitch this service anymore. I think we're done. We can stop right there.
I was left with a couple questions, so we'll have a little bit to talk about.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about, you were at with this from the beginning, so maybe you could tell us a little bit about how this came about and what the goals were.
Yeah, so it's just over a year ago now. I can't believe it. It feels both much shorter than that and much longer both at the same time, which is strange. So I joined, I came over to Redmond about 2 years ago, and for a while I worked with the workflow team. So, you know, the other use of XAML. I know you're a big XAML fan. The other use of XAML doing the workflow foundation. And I was with those guys for a year when there was a bit of a reorg and Scott Guthrie took over Azure. And I got an opportunity then. Someone said, hey, we're going to do some mobile stuff. I know you're in this mobile space. You want to go and work on this? And I snatched, snatched the opportunity, of course. And the remit was extremely open at that time was, you know, how do we make Windows Azure even more attractive for mobile developers? And that was it. That was the goal, you know, wow. Go and solve this problem. And so we spent a lot of time reaching out to customers. I got to try and soak into kind of what we thought of as mobile developers. But what we really mean by that, it turned out, was people building apps. People building these apps that are now distributed through some kind of marketplace, be it the iOS App Store or the Windows Store. That's what we really meant by mobile, it transpired. So we tried to get into that, you know, tried to get into the mindset of that. I attended hackathons. I went to conferences. I met with many, many startups and asked them, you know, what are you building? Does it have a back end? Because that's what Azure is obviously all about, right? It's about cloud services. What cloud services do you need? If you have them already, are you using Azure? If not, why not? And a few themes started to emerge. In particular, you know, I've talked about this in the past. The three personas that we started to spot consistently when we spoke to individuals and organizations were: number one persona is a hobbyist. Let me ask Jesse, I don't know the answer to this ahead of time. Do you have an app you've built for Windows Phone or anything?
Oh, I have a couple of very poor apps I built for Windows Phone, yes.
And is it how you make a living? Is it how you pay your mortgage?
No, I am not your professional app developer. I build them in my spare time. My full-time job is working as a technical evangelist for Telerik.
Bingo. So you are persona number one, which is actually pretty common, is the hobbyist developer. Now, you know, you maybe have some mild hopes of shipping the next Instagram. You wouldn't be upset with $1 billion offer from Facebook. But you have a limited amount of time in which you can invest in this app building. And what we found when we spoke to this audience is that they would often prioritize working on client stuff rather than adding the back-end features that they want. They do want push notifications and authentication, but they know that sticking all this stuff together and going learning Windows Azure is tough. So a lot of them were making the decision to just focus on a client application because that's all I've got time for. My best example of this is one of my colleagues who works on the Windows Azure team, builds the fabric that runs Windows Azure. And I found out he had an app. So I went to speak to him. I said, hey, tell me about your app. I hear you have an app. He's like, yeah. I said, so what backend services are you using? He said, oh, you know, I do it all in my spare time, so I've not had time to add a backend. And that really tripped something in my mind where a backend engineer working on Windows Azure has kind of found he didn't have the time to go and add the backend features he wanted.
That's brilliant. That sums up the need right there.
Well, and that's one category. And then the second persona was the professional app developer. So he is differentiated from the first guy because this is how he's going to make a living now. Now, it might be one guy in a garage. I met a few of these. Or it might be 10 people in a loft in San Francisco working on an app. And when we spoke to these guys, we found a sort of similar set of feedback was around, we're going to prioritize the client. The modern app, or a tenet of the modern app, is that the user experience has to be incredible, right? People are really expecting a heightened level, a heightened investment in the UI, which I know makes you happy as a UI guy, and me too as a UI guy. And so I think that's great. And what we're finding is people are prioritizing. They've got a limited amount of resource. They're very much in the startup mindset, which means they will build a minimum viable product and ship it. And so even though they want these back-end features, they really think it's going to give them a competitive advantage. In some cases, they're getting pushed to the back because it's, you know, it's hard work. Also, the other thing is that these guys are betting their career on this application. They're betting their livelihood on it. So it has to be reliable and highly available. And going building that yourself is a challenge. So, you know, what started to emerge as obvious to us is if we can create a service that makes it super easy to add the back-end features you need to a client application, and you get free reliability and free availability, and you don't have to worry about deployment and managing a complex server project and learning how to glue all these pieces together, and you can just focus on writing the code you want to write to satisfy your application's needs, then we have a potential big opportunity there. The third persona is the guy who that doesn't seem attractive to, is, you know, the back-end developer. So when I talk about this, I often show a picture of Scott Guthrie here as my little joke that Scott's like this veteran back-end dev. He doesn't need any of this stuff. And he's like what we think of as our classic back-end dev who can knock out, you know, a web service in a few minutes and get it deployed to Azure, and it just doesn't faze him because he's very experienced at that stuff. And so we didn't focus on him at first when we started to build mobile services because we thought he's already covered by Azure. It has all the features he wants. It's just he already is comfortable pulling all that infrastructure together and taking advantage of the vast power. What we found since we've launched, actually, is one of our biggest customer segments of interest in mobile services is back-end devs, because they just want to get to market quickly. They don't want to write a lot of infrastructure code. And so it turns out that we seem to be appealing to all stripes in this, in all three personas, even though we only really set out to do two at first. So now when we talk about planning and we think about the future, we try and think about all three. So in a nutshell, that's kind of how mobile services came to be.
Okay, so I clearly fall into the first category, which is the hobbyist. And I know that I need back-end support, but I'm kind of an old school guy, and I tend to think in terms of a database and tables and rows. Is that the way I should be thinking about mobile services?
Absolutely. So when you get a mobile service, what you get is a SQL database, and it is a good old fashioned SQL Server Azure database. So it has tables, it has schema, it has all of these things that you expect and are familiar with. You know, it's a relational DB, and you can connect that thing directly and do your reporting. It's your database. And then you get, this is kind of the bit where we do most of our work, is this middle tier that automatically connects to that database, that makes it very easy for you to add tables, that makes it very easy for you to create an API that your client application, so that could be a Windows 8 app, a Windows Phone app, or an iOS, you know, an Apple application, and start using those features. And we pull in authentication, and we also make it easy to send push notifications. And what we really try and do by offering this as a service is pull all of these things together to be more than the sum of their parts. So we make it very easy, like a single line of code, seriously, you should try this, via Twitter or Facebook, right, to your application. And then you can put a setting which applies a policy, which means that only authenticated users can work with data in a table, say, can perform an insert on a table, or can perform an update, or perform a read. And what's more is you can write these little scripts written in JavaScript that run on the server and sit in between your database and your client application, but they're running securely on the server. And they're a great way of securing that data, because that's something everybody needs to do. You know, if you're building a social application, then you need to put some smarts in your service that says, hey, only Jesse's friends can see Jesse's data. I don't want anyone just seeing his data. If you're building some kind of social app, for example. And again, because we've taken care of all the authentication, all of the talking to SQL, to achieve that scenario, it's really just sort of two or three lines of JavaScript code. And the best thing is that's running securely on the server. So it's not something that can be tampered with on a client.
Well, let's take some of those features apart one by one, because each of them is very powerful. And the three big ones that I heard you say were the ability to create tables in a database, authentication, and push notification. So let me start you with the tables. Am I generating these tables based on SQL statements, based on my class, my code? Is this code first? How am I approaching that?
So there's two ways you can do it. You can go into your SQL database and you can actually create the tables. That's fine. If you're happy in SQL Management Studio, you can do that. However, we realized that a lot of our audience, you know, we talked about the hobbyist and the client-focused developer, don't particularly want to go and learn SQL Server Management Studio, or even really want to learn SQL in some cases. They're just happy with the notion of tables and storage. So we made it very easy for you to add a new table in the Windows Azure portal. So when you create a new mobile service, you can go to the data tab and click create a new table, and we'll go and create the table for you in the database. And when you do that, you can apply these middle tier policies that say who can perform inserts, updates, deletes, and reads. You can make it so everybody can do it, or only people with an application key, or only authenticated users, or you can lock that down to be only administrators. So that's how you create tables. So most people do it in the portal is the short answer.
Let me interrupt you, Josh. Let's say I create a table and I put in four fields and I'm working with my class and I realize I need a fifth field. Is that possible to do? Hard? Easy?
Yeah, it's very easy. So one of the things we wanted to do with mobile services was make it fun. Fun is a key ingredient. It should be really fun to develop an app on mobile services. And when I was doing that original customer reach out that we talked about, we did find a big affinity between mobile developers and NoSQL stores. So things like React and MongoDB, etc., etc. And when we really pressed on that, we found one of the biggest attractors was the lack of impedance, the sort of zero friction approach to development with these NoSQL stores. And that is that you can just throw a JSON document in there, and I don't have to do all of this upfront data modeling and schematization. So we thought, well, that's great. But what people really miss once they've started using these systems is the ability to access that data and run queries over it and run reports over it. And SQL's great at that. So we thought, how can we get the best of both worlds? And so we created this thing called dynamic schematization. So what happens is the mobile service middle tier, when it sees an object arriving, you know, it's basically a JSON API. When we see a new JSON object arriving and being inserted into a table or updated, we look at the properties of that JSON object and we say, do we have columns for these? And if we don't, we'll create them on the fly. So what you have is a dynamic schematizing SQL. And that's awesome during development. It's a tremendous amount of fun. I don't have to go in and sort of think about my schema. We just infer the types and add the columns. And what's more, once you go to production, you might not want a malicious bad guy adding columns to your table willy-nilly, right? So you can turn off dynamic schematization, at which point we won't create new columns for you.
That's great. So just to be clear, I can go create a class, use a library to export that to be a JSON document, and then import that JSON into my mobile services and have it create the appropriate tables and rows and columns.
Pretty much, yeah. This is the C# version of the world. Of course, we have an Objective-C version of the world, and we have a JavaScript version of the world. In the C# version of the world, you create a class, and you can optionally attribute the properties to map to the table column names. Otherwise, we'll just use the property names as you specified them. And then you create this thing called a mobile service client, which is a bit like a service proxy, you know, that's what you use to talk to mobile services. Now, underneath this, I must stress, is just a very simple HTTP API. We just created this client to make it even easier to use. And so then you call client insert async. So we use all the new great C# async stuff. And you pass in an instance of that class. And it's at that point, if the properties don't exist in the database, that we'll go and create them.
That's brilliant.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, you should try it. So should your listeners.
All right. So the second thing that you mentioned was authentication. And I know that you spoke with John Galloway already. He and I worked about a year ago on a project called the Full Stack Project, and we were trying to build a back end with per user authentication. So my data is kept separate from your data, which got pretty complicated pretty quickly. Yep. It sounds like this simplifies that problem.
Yeah, I think the approach you took there was very kind of policy based, right? So yes. You sort of said that when a user comes along and tries to work with data, we're going to assign a policy that says this data belongs to that user. And we actually started down that road. We started looking at, we call that record owner, is in terms of that only the record owner can work with that record. But the real problem there is, how do you build a social app where I share data? So I have an app called Dutu that is a shared to-do list, and it's quite fun. I can create a to-do list, which is, you know, the modern hello world, but I can actually then email my wife and say, will you share this list with me? And then we interact with the list together. So she checks items off, it appears on my phone. She adds a new item, it appears on my phone, and vice versa. And so if it was tied to a user, that you couldn't do that, right? Policies, what we found with policies is they were great at certain scenarios and they made it so easy, but they kind of walked you into a corner where you would suddenly not be able to achieve another nearby scenario because the policy is restrictive. So we decided not to do policies and instead focused on allowing people to write a little bit of code. So if you want to do that in mobile services, what you can do is you can write one of these scripts that run in the middle tier. And it's just a simple function in JavaScript. So if you want a script to run, let's say, when someone is querying data, then you write a piece of JavaScript that is function read. The read is the name of the function. And it takes three parameters. The first is the query. So that's the thing the user's asking for. That's like the predicate, the were clause, whatever you want to call it, that the user's asking for. The second object is the user. And you can trust that object because it's running on the server and it's been authenticated by mobile services. So that will identify who the user is who's making that query. And then the final object, that the parameter that's passed into the function, is the request. And the request object allows you to control the flow of execution. So you can do a few things. You can say, go ahead, perform the query and return the results to the user. I ain't interested in this. It's fine. Or you can intercept the request and decide to do something else instead, entirely instead. You could just send back an error response going, that's a silly thing to do. Why are you doing that? Or what is very common is you can augment the incoming query. So, for example, I can perform a query to a friends table, find out who all the friends of the current user are, and then augment that incoming query parameter and say, hey, make sure this guy only sees data from his current friends. And then you call request.execute, and we carry on executing the query, but we've added that predicate. So it basically opens it up so that almost any scenario you want to achieve is just two, three, you know, just a few lines of JavaScript. And you can start to do pretty much anything you can think of, really. You can also execute SQL directly, like T-SQL directly against the database. If you want to go for maximum performance, you can write complex joins and twists and, you know, coalesces and subqueries and return those results to the user. But the key thing is you can use that user object that was injected into the function to make decisions around what that user can do.
Now, these little scripts, are these things that people are writing individually, or is there an emerging library of scripts?
There isn't an emerging library of scripts right now, and I think you've highlighted one of our gaps that we're going to fill very soon. And that is, there isn't an easy way to share scripts. I mean, the way you paste a script, the way you enter a script is you actually enter it into the portal right now. Now, very soon, probably by the time your listeners hear this podcast, actually, we will have a CLI, a command line interface, that will allow you to upload your scripts. So you can edit them on your client application using Sublime or whatever tool you like, and you can upload them via the CLI. Right now, you edit them in the portal. So the only way for us to share scripts, if I wanted to show you my cool script, would be to send it to you in an email. You know, it would be sort of cut and paste. There's a couple of things we're going to do about that over time. So we're running in Node. The reason it's JavaScript is that the runtime is actually executing in Node.js. So we will provide the ability to use NPM modules. So there is a very rich ecosystem of modules that can be used from NPM that exist already, and we'll make it so you can use those. And by doing that, we'll add the ability to share scripts. So that is something we want to enable. I want you, Jesse, and other people being able to share your ideas and really build out that mobile services ecosystem.
That sounds great. And you're using Node.js, so you made Glenn Block happy.
Glenn's very happy, yeah.
And tell me about push notification. One of the tasks that Windows 8 programmers have to address is the ability to send push notifications for live tiles and for toast notifications. Does Azure Mobile Service help me with that?
Yep, we do. We very much think of it as one of our core tenets. You mentioned this earlier, you know, authentication data and push. So push notifications is this way of sending messages to an application. And what's cool about it is it works even when the application isn't alive. So this is a common thing across, you know, most of the platforms, Android, iOS, Windows Phone, Windows 8, all have this system. And we want to make it extremely easy because, to be honest, today, there's a fair bit of code to write if you want to invoke the, let's say, Windows 8 in this case. You want to invoke Windows notification services. You have to, first of all, log on with your client secret and your package SID that you got from the store. You'll then get a bearer token back. You have to keep your eye on that bearer token because at some point it will expire. And you use that bearer token to call a different endpoint and send actual push notifications. And to send these push notifications, you have to build up these fairly complex XML templates. And, you know, this, I mean, I actually went through this exercise. There's quite a bit of code to write. You know, there's quite a bit of stuff to do. And all I want to do is send a push notification to some guy. So with mobile services, we tried to turn it on its head and said, well, look, if you enter your credentials for WNS, so that's your client secret and your package SID, into mobile services in the portal, then we'll make it so it's a single line of JavaScript to send the push notification. So you call push.wns.send. And then, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there are something like 28 different templates for different types of push notifications you can send. Lots of different tiles and lots of different toasts, and then some badges and some raw notifications. And so we rolled all of those into our API. So I can say send toast text04, which is the name of the Windows template. And all I have to do is specify the channel URL, which is what we think of as kind of the address of the application on a device, and the payload, which is a nice, simple JSON format. So it's somewhat easier to work with than trying to build up the XML templates. And, you know, you can now very easily build an application that sends push notifications to, for example, Jesse's friends when Jesse performs a check-in at a certain location, is something we see quite a bit of. Or in my Do-To app, which is the shared to-do application, what happens now is when my wife adds things to our shopping list or to our camping trip list, I actually get a toast notification on my iOS device that says, you know, Jill added something to the camping list. So I can see it right there. And if I'm driving back on the way home and I'm passing the camping store, I can pop in and pick it. And it was so easy. I spent so little time building out what would have been a complex back end, because all of these services I want to use, I can just hook into. And I just spent time writing the functionality and none of the integration code.
Well, all of that sounds, I mean, truthfully sounds terrific. My limited experience so far is going to the portal and doing the tutorial application, which goes very, very smoothly. But I guess my question is, if I want to go beyond that and I want to learn how to do these different things, like create tables out of my class or create a push notification and work with authentication, is there a central place for documentation about this, or how do I go about learning how to do this?
There is, yeah. So we have a developer portal. What do we call it? The developer site? The developer portal on WindowsAzure.com. So we should put this in the, if you have show notes, Jesse.
Yes.
It's aka.ms/mobile services. And that will take you to our dev portal. And in there, you'll see matching our features, you'll see the data tutorials, you'll see the authentication tutorials, and you'll see the push tutorials. And we've actually received really good feedback on our tutorials, that they're really nice walkthroughs. So that will take you through step by step how to set up authentication to get people signing in via Facebook, Twitter, Google, or Microsoft account. It will also show you step by step how to start a file new project, create, register your app with the Windows Store, enter those credentials into the Windows Azure portal and get to the point where you're sending your first push notification in about 10 or 15 minutes, because there are some external processes you have to go through registering your app. But it's extremely quick, extremely lightweight. And the feedback's been great about those, that people find them very easy to follow.
How many people are using mobile services at this point? Is it a full-fledged released product that's out in the community?
Yeah, so we have thousands of apps now, thousands of services, and we know many of those are in production. We have a serious number, actually. I mean, I don't know if I'm at liberty to share the number, but we have a serious number of production Windows 8 apps running on mobile services, including some really big names. So Johnson & Johnson, who everyone knows as the family business, uses mobile services for their digital healthcare app, and that's in production right now. So absolutely, yeah, we are in preview. But a couple of things. So mobile services is incredibly simple. It's a very simple middle tier. We're just about making it easy. We've written the infrastructure code so you don't have to. So we have extremely high reliability. And we're using SQL Server as our data store. And SQL Server is not in preview. SQL Server is a fully supported, fully fledged Windows Azure service that doesn't have the preview tag. Because we're so simple and we have such high confidence, and we're operating at a very high nines SLA already, above 3.9s, we have been agreeing with customers that want to go into production, and we have been agreeing an SLA with them, like kind of a go-live license ahead of time. So if any of your listeners say, hey, I want to build an app, I want to use mobile services, and I want some extra confidence, will you guys agree an SLA with me? Then I'd encourage them to get in touch with me, and we can put my email address or Twitter handle in the show notes.
And SLA stands for?
Service level agreement. So essentially, we will guarantee a certain amount of uptime.
And you're saying you're already achieving 3.9, so 99.9% reliability.
Above that so far, yeah.
That's extraordinary. I remember when I worked for AT&T, the motto was 5.9s of reliability, but that's the phone system, and that's, everything rides on that.
Right. Well, we think that is pretty competitive. 3.9s. It does account for some potential outage, but it's very small.
Yes. Excellent. So tell me, I know that you've explained about the portal and we will put a link, but if I'm a developer and I want to work my way through this material, my first step is to go to the developer portal?
Yeah, it's go to windowsazure.com. And well, there's a couple of options here. If you already have access to Windows Azure, like maybe you have an MSDN subscription, so you get some free Azure with that, or you have Windows Azure at work, or for some other reason you have access to it, then what you may need to do is enable the Windows Azure Mobile Services preview feature. We'll add a link. There's a guide that walks you through that. We'll add a link for that to the show notes. Alternative, if you don't have any access, if you don't have an MSDN subscription, then everybody can get 10 mobile services for free. And so you can sign up for the free trial for WindowsAzure.com, and that's very visible on WindowsAzure.com. You'll just see it in the top right-hand corner. And the free trial is a 90-day trial of Windows Azure. But actually, the mobile services, the 10 free mobile services, we give to you without time constraint. I'm not allowed to say forever for some reason. The legal guys don't like that. So I have to say that there is no time constraint. It's yours. We won't take it away at the end of 90 days. Those 10 free mobile services are yours for as long as I can imagine.
Great. What happens after the 10? What's the pricing look like?
Well, at the moment, the way that works is when you get your 10 free mobile services, you're running on a shared environment. So we are running on the same infrastructure that runs Windows Azure websites, if you're familiar with those. And that means everybody gets their own process, effectively, and it's very tightly sandboxed. So my mobile service can't do anything bad to your mobile service, and your mobile service can't look at my mobile service's data, etc. And that's all rock solid secure. However, it does mean I'm sharing a VM. So if I want to go to production, and or I want more than mobile services, I can actually choose to move my account to a reserved set of VMs. So you can start to pay for that. And that just charges you for the cost of the virtual machine that you run on. So there is no charge for mobile services per se. It is the cost of the Azure infrastructure. And a small VM, I mean, I can look up the price now, is pretty competitive. And you can have, I think, up to 100 mobile services will allow you to run in your reserved instances.
And talk to me about scaling up and flexibility with scale.
Yeah, so you can scale up to 3 virtual machines. And given that we're running on Node, and that's just the middle tier, right? So you can scale that up to 3 virtual machines. That will handle a tremendous amount of traffic coming from mobile services, well into the millions of requests per day. Depending what you're doing, of course. I mean, you can write code there, so anyone can challenge that by writing some code that does some crazy stuff. But we already have some customers pulling in some pretty big numbers running on our virtual machines. And then there's scaling the database. And so the way that SQL Azure works is you just scale based on storage. So you can go all the way up to 150 gigs of storage in a SQL database. And you just pay a monthly charge based on the amount of data you're storing. So that's the two factors in terms of scaling. In terms of cost, unsurprisingly, there are also the cost factors. So when you scale up to VMs, you will pay for those VMs. When you scale up the amount of storage you use, that's how SQL database will charge you, is based on the amount of storage you use. And the one other factor is egress. So the amount of bandwidth that you're consuming. We usually see that this is fairly, it isn't a scary number for most mobile apps, because they tend to not be passing around massive payloads because they're often on a 3G connection or an LTE connection, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, all of it sounds almost too good to be true, and that forces me to ask you where the limits are, where the limitations, and what I might run into that I say, ah, that's what I can't do with this.
So I think our most obvious limitations now, we talked about one before, is it's hard to share code. So it's hard for me to share code with you. I'd literally be copying and pasting it. And that becomes is actually a symptom of a problem that we're going to fix very soon, which is that you enter the code into the portal. So I mentioned that we're adding our command line interface soon that will make it very easy for me to work on files locally, and I'll be able to upload those files. And we get to a world, though, then where you can easily imagine source control. So I could have, for example, a local Git repo that I can manage my source, and then I use the CLI to upload the file. However, wouldn't it be cool if I could just Git push those changes up to my portal and the changes happen automatically? So these are adding, all of these kind of features we think of as maturity are coming pretty soon. We mentioned scripts, and what we find is a lot of people love the way we let them work with data, and they love the way they can write these scripts that get in between the data and the client. But then they find that they want to do something similar. They want to run some code on the server, but it has nothing to do with data. I just want to create a service operation, you know, that maybe it calls Twitter, or because it's very easy to invoke other HTTP services from the scripts in mobile services. That's just a line or two of code. But why do I have to create a table if I don't want to use the table? Because we actually have a bunch of customers today that are creating virtual tables, we call them, where they just want an operation that runs in the sky and doesn't store anything in the SQL database, but they want to run one of these scripts. So we'll be adding service operations very soon to the service, within a few months, I would hope. And that will make it a first-class idea that you can now write a bit of script that just listens on a HTTP endpoint. Another one is, how do I go and clean up my data? So imagine you're building a location check-in app, and you've decided that in your situation, you don't need to keep check-ins for more than a month. And you want to go and clean and start harvesting that old data and getting rid of it, because it's just costing you money and no one ever looks at it. Then how would you do that? There's no way at the moment of executing inside mobile services on a scheduled basis. Well, that isn't going to be true for very long. In fact, it's highly possible by the time this goes out, because we're shipping in just a few days probably, people will be able to use our scheduler feature that will allow them to execute scripts on a timed basis. So you can say, hey, you know, I want to run this bit of JavaScript and I want to run it every night at 2 o'clock. Or I want to run it every 15 minutes, or I want to run it once. And that's so easy. Go into the portal, choose your schedule, write your script, press save, enable, you're done. And so that's, I mean, I think that's what we think cloud programming should be like. You know, it should just be zero friction, zero impedance. And those are some of the biggest obstacles that we see customers having right now. Another common pain point is that they want to support Android, right? So we have Windows 8 support, we have Windows Phone support, and one of the great things about mobile services is cross-platform. And so we just announced a week ago full support for iOS devices. So now you can use our native Objective-C client to work with data and sign users into an iOS device in just a single line of code, or maybe two, given it's Objective-C. And what's more, you can now send push notifications to APNS, the Apple push notification server, in a single line of code. Now, everybody wants that for Android is the next thing. It's like, oh, great, when do I get Android? So we'll work on that and we'll get that to you in the future, very soon.